I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
This is Barry Truce. I'm Hank Klibanoff. A quick recap. The coroner's inquest is in its second day. So far, we've only heard from one person who witnessed the police shooting of A.C. Hall. That's Eloise Franklin. And that's about to change. Another civilian witness will take the stand. And he'll contradict Eloise's testimony in some important ways. Barnett and Doris Hopper were a young couple, a white couple, as you know, living in Macon. Newlyweds. We found that Barnett worked at a tire company and Doris, as you may remember, worked at the Shrimp Boat restaurant. Now, it was Barnett's gun that was stolen, and it was Doris who said she saw the guy who stole it. Both will testify. Barnett Hopper takes the stand first. The attorney defending the police officers is the state legislator, Denmark Groover, a segregationist. He takes Barnett Hopper back to the morning after the shooting. Now, that's when the police discovered the pistol in the grass behind the school. Don't forget now, we're using actors here.
When you first saw it at that some distance, did you make any statement as to whether it looked like yours?
Yes, sir. I said it looked like mine.
And it did. But up close, he could see obvious differences. The main one, the gun wasn't even the same brand as his.
I examined the pistol and said that it was not mine.
What about the color of the barrel and cylinder?
It is all the same. Mine is black, just exactly like that one.
Okay, so just imagine you're a member of the coroner's jury. What have you just heard? The police have miraculously found a gun that looked just like the one stolen from the Hopper's car. But it wasn't the same gun. Where did it come from? And what are the chances it was just lying out there near a path that school children walked on every day? Could the gun have been planted by police? Well, it's possible. Some would say likely. I mean, the thinking there is that police probably felt a need to link Hall to that gun to justify shooting him. But there's no way to know now. We turned again to David Davis, the sheriff of Macon Bibb County.
Now, I don't have any direct knowledge of this, but back in the day, I'm sure that that kind of thing was done. There's a term called a throwdown gun. Mm-hmm. The folklore is if somebody gets in trouble and they need to say the guy got a gun, the throwdown gun, and that's the gun he had.
Sheriff Davis was careful to say that he'd never actually seen a police officer throw down a gun. Davis continues, and here he's talking about Barnett Hopper.
So they found a gun. So that sort of supports the supposition that Mr. Hall had a gun. But the problem is, he gets on the stand and they say, hey, is this your gun? He's like, no, man, I ain't never seen that gun. I don't know what y'all talking about.
Now, Howard Moore, the young African-American attorney representing A.C. Hall's mother, also had some serious suspicions about the gun. He and I talked about it on that day in October 2018, when we both went to Macon and sat in the same courtroom where the inquest had been held. Now, Moore's a careful man. I mean, he is a lawyer. So he wouldn't come right out and say the gun was a plant. I asked him how important Hopper's testimony regarding the gun was.
Well, I felt that was a good testimony that it wasn't the gun they found in the field wasn't Mr. Hopper's gun, because I felt that excluded A.C. as a probable burglar of the car as such. And my first thought was, well, who found the gun? The gun was found by the police. And so who probably brought the gun to the scene? Some police officer. Now, I can't say that that actually happened, because that would be a libel on the police. But a police officer found the gun. They found it the next day, even though they'd had a search the night before, and they used flashlights looking for it. They didn't find any gun. But the next morning, they do.
The police department's handling of the reported gun theft was remarkable from beginning to end. First, of course, Officers Brown and Durden asked the Hoppers to join them in the patrol car. Second, why was Barnett Hopper at the crime scene, inside the crime scene, the next day, looking for his gun? What kind of training did these policemen receive? Well, let's look at that. Poor policing and poor police training in the South were as traditional as grits. Keep in mind what we said before. Most Southern police forces evolved from slave patrols, white men hunting down black people. By the 1940s in the South, the racial attitude behind that dynamic had not gone away, and everyone knew it. It was also carefully documented in a 1944 book, An American Dilemma. The book, written and edited by Gunnar Myrdal, packed massive research into 1,483 pages. Even today, Myrdal's book remains the most comprehensive examination ever of race relations in the United States. And here's what Myrdal had to say. The average white Southern policeman is a promoted poor white with a legal sanction to use a weapon. His social heritage has taught him to despise the Negroes, and he has had little education which could have changed him. The result is that probably no group of whites in America have a lower opinion of the Negro people and are more fixed in their view than Southern policemen. Myrdal relied heavily on research by a respected Southern sociologist, Arthur Raper, who studied the police forces of 112 cities, towns, and villages in 14 Southern states. He published his research in 1940, and what he found was damning. In many Southern towns, he wrote, almost anyone outside the penitentiary who weighs enough and is not blind or crippled can be considered as a police candidate. Raper's study found that nearly 60% of police departments he studied had little or no training. Some just handed out a small pamphlet with rules for the police department. Here's how Dr. Raper put it. One day, he is a barber, textile worker, truck driver, mechanic, or a private night watchman. The next day, with a uniform, badge, and gun, he is a full-fledged police officer. Okay, yes, that was in the 1940s. But get this. In the year that A.C. Hall was killed, 1962, Georgia's own lieutenant governor described police training this way. It's a startling fact that many of our Georgia police departments merely hand their officers a badge and a gun and without any training send them out to enforce the law. This could well have been the case with Brown and Durden, who were rookies in 1962. Brown had come into policing from having been a hoist operator at a brick company. Durden had been a welder at a local manufacturing company. I mean, this hardly disqualified them from becoming police officers, but we really don't know how much training they actually got. We do know that the first state police academy in Georgia didn't even open until 1966. The FBI filled some of that gap by making training films available for law enforcement.
There can be no such thing as a routine arrest. For these men know that the greatest danger is carelessness. Stay alert and stay alive.
The lesson behind all this was that the safety of the police officer was paramount.
The first rule of law enforcement is to go home at the end of your shift.
That's Seth Stoughton, a University of South Carolina law professor and a former policeman.
And what that's communicating is that policing is inherently dangerous, that it is so dangerous that officers, as a matter of sheer survival, have to be attuned to those dangers, and everything they do should be directed at making it home safely at the end of their shift.
That sort of training has one inevitable consequence, and this may explain what Brown and Durden faced. Police officers often react to a situation without having all the information they need. Back in the day, this was called shoot first and ask questions later. But what about that? What if you wait to acquire more information and the suspect shoots you while you're waiting? Cops are trained not to hesitate.
Officers endanger themselves or put themselves in danger, sometimes by not using force. That's the thrust of a lot of this training.
And the common phrase that police officers use?
It is better to be tried by 12 than carried by 6.
Stoughton runs down a number of research results regarding policing and race. First, the idea that white people tend to overestimate the age of black boys. Second, whites tend to perceive black men as being larger than they are. He says police officers are like most people. They tend to find what they're looking for. Say an officer goes into a situation expecting to see a gun. He's likely to perceive whatever's in the subject's hand as a gun, even if it's a cell phone, or a wallet, or some other object. We've seen many such cases. 1999, New York City. 4 NYPD cops fire at Amadou Diallo 41 times after he pulls his wallet from his jacket. 2013, Chicago. A police officer fires 16 times at Flint Farmer, who was holding a cell phone. 2018, Sacramento, California. Police fire 20 times, killing Stefan Clark, who was holding his cell phone. Stoughton adds one more bit of information that I find by turns fascinating and frightening.
There's some psychological research that's found that when I am holding a gun, not just when I have one on me, but particularly when I am holding a gun, I am even more likely to perceive you as also holding a firearm.
The U.S. Supreme Court established clear rules for an officer firing on a fleeing suspect. But that decision didn't come until 1985. That's like, well, nearly a quarter of a century after the shooting of A.C. Hall. In Tennessee versus Garner, a Memphis police officer shot and killed a teenager as he ran from a house he was suspected of burglarizing. The court ruled that a police officer may not use deadly force to prevent an escape unless, and I'm quoting here, the officer has probable cause to believe that the suspect poses a significant threat of death or serious injury to the officer or others. Now, Professor Stoughton says the ruling set the stage for police training for decades to come.
One of the phrases that officers hear in formal training, as well as informally from other officers, is, "I was in fear for my life." Often, although not always, the legal aspects of deadly force training start with that statement. You can use deadly force when you are in fear for your life. In fact, even in some interviews, their supervisors or the investigators who are reviewing the incident will ask the leading question, were you in fear for your life? Or in what way were you in fear for your life? Or how were you in fear for your life?
So let's go back to 1962 and to the Macon Police Department. There's one more thing I want to tell you about that organization. The man in charge was Police Chief Lewis B. McCollum. 2 years after A.C. Hall was shot, he was fired. Why? For incompetence and neglect of duty. Well, what had McCallum done? Well, he'd given a two-way police radio to a civilian who wasn't even a police officer. But it's even worse than that. The man he gave the radio to was the head of the white supremacist Macon Citizens Council.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
As we return to the courtroom, here's a good question. What if Barnett Hopper had lied and said that the gun the police found was the gun stolen from him? Well, I think the jury would have believed him. A.C. Hall would have been branded a criminal, and we wouldn't be telling you this story. But Hopper didn't lie, and the presence of that gun in this courtroom became a huge liability for the police. They thought they could use it as evidence of A.C. Hall's guilt, but it was evidence of something else, wasn't it? If you're on the coroner's jury, you're thinking, first we find out the kid was shot in the back. Now we learn that the gun was probably planted by the police. What's next? Barnett Hopper returns to the events of that night. He says he was certain the gun was in his car that day. In our reenactment, prosecutor Jack Gautier shows Hopper a series of photographs taken at the scene of the shooting.
What did you do when you found the pistol missing?
I called for my mother to call the police.
Now, you've heard this before, and you've heard what happened next. But those five men sitting as the jury, every detail is new to them.
We turned into the school there on Hazel Street. We were circling, and as we passed someone, we slowed up to see if my wife could recognize him.
Did you see any other people in or about the schoolyard when you turned in there?
Only one person.
Who was that?
It was described later as A.C. Hall.
That's the deceased?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, did you see A.C. Hall before the police car got up to him, or at the time it got to him, or what?
As we turned in, the headlights, we could see him to the left in the headlights, and as soon as he was directly between the headlights, my wife identified him.
What did your wife say?
My wife said, "That's the man right there."
What happened after your wife made that statement?
The man started running.
Did any person in the automobile say anything to him as he was running?
The officers, as we were along right here, started yelling for him to stop.
What officer?
Both officers yelled for him to halt.
This is the first contradiction of Eloise Franklin's testimony. A.C. Hall's girlfriend had claimed that neither officer said a word before they opened fire. Now, perhaps she just didn't hear the warnings. Perhaps she was simply wrong. Both Mr. and Mrs. Hopper, and later the two officers, testified that they shouted several warnings. Or perhaps Eloise was right, and the officers shouted nothing at all at A.C. Hall.
Were any shots fired while the automobile was in motion?
No, sir.
Now, which of the officers did the shooting?
Both officers fired.
Which one fired first?
I believe the officer on the right fired first.
Which one was that?
Officer Durden.
Do you know how many times he fired his pistol?
I believe it was twice. I'm not sure. I'd say twice.
Officer Brown fired two or not?
I would say that he fired more than twice. I don't know the exact number.
Did you see A.C. Hall fall?
Yes, sir.
Had you gotten out of the car before he fell or not?
Yes, sir. I'd gotten out of the car.
Did you go over to where he was?
Yes, sir. I walked up behind Officer Durden.
Barnett Hopper's testimony now takes a critical turn. In fact, I'm referring to it as the turn. Hopper claims he saw A.C. Hall stop running and turn back toward the officers. And as he turned, Hopper said, A.C. made what appeared to be a threatening motion with his right arm. This, of course, is the justification for the shooting.
When you saw A.C. Hall running, did you see him do anything other than run?
Yes, sir. Right after he passed the mound of dirt, he had turned and his right arm was coming out from his right side, and that is when the officers yelled a warning and started firing.
Were you able to see anything or not in his hand?
No, sir. I could not tell that he had anything in his hand.
I'm going to interrupt this 1962 testimony to tell you about a similar case that played out just a few years ago. It's from 2014, Chicago. Police told a story similar to that of Officers Brown and Durden. It's the case of Laquan McDonald. Like A.C. Hall, he was 17. Like A.C. Hall, he was black. The cop who killed McDonald was white, Jason Van Dyke. He was on the scene for 6 seconds before he shot at Laquan McDonald 16 times.
We're here because Jason Van Dyke didn't value the life of Laquan McDonald enough to do anything but shoot him.
That was from the closing arguments in the case, and Jason Van Dyke was convicted. But listen to what Van Dyke's partner said about Laquan McDonald. His right shoulder and right arm had come up in front of him. He turned and looked in our direction. And what did Barnett Hopper say? A.C. Hall turned, and his right arm was coming out from his right side. The similarities are striking. So back to the courtroom in Macon for the coroner's inquest. Another person who was there, from beginning to end, was a black reporter, Tresvant Anderson. He was one of the top reporters at the Pittsburgh Courier, the most widely circulated black newspaper in America. Civil rights in the South was Anderson's beat, and he turned up to cover the A.C. Hall inquest. One of my former students, who's conducting research on this case, Catherine Dautrick, found Anderson's handwritten notes from the case at the Atlanta University Center. She found news articles and opinion columns he wrote, and page after page of notes and observations. Anderson, forced to sit separately from white reporters, took it all in. He kept a close eye on A.C. Hall's mom, Curly Hall. Now, she had just buried her son the day before, and now she's back in the courtroom again, heartbroken, listening to people who didn't know A.C. describe his final moments. At one point, Anderson was scribbling Barnett Hopper's critical testimony that he saw nothing in A.C. Hall's hand that night. Just then, Anderson looked over at Curly Hall and wrote one more observation in his notebook. Mother weeping. As the testimony continues, Denmark Groover, now remember, he's the lawyer representing the police, returns to that moment that I've called the turn. Barnett Hopper is still on the stand, and Groover wants Hopper to say the same thing about the turn again. In fact, Groover says it for him.
Mr. Hopper, I believe you testified in response to a question of Mr. Gauthier as follows. Right after he passed the mound of dirt, he had turned and his right arm was coming out from his right side.
Yes, sir.
At that time, in which direction had he turned?
I could not tell exactly from that because the car was sort of rocking-like. They had brought it to a stop, and I had lost just a momentary glance of him. He had turned, and he was almost full-facing us.
Was facing you?
Yes, sir.
Was he in that position when his right arm was coming out from his right side?
Yes, sir.
Attorney Moore makes Hopper go through it all again. His skepticism clearly comes through.
And, sir, did you testify that, and let me get the words right, his right
arm was coming out from his right side.
His right arm was coming out from his right side. He had been shot, had he not?
No, sir. Up until that time, it was not known to me whether he had been shot or not. He wasn't shot. Shot at, I will say, until his right arm was in motion. The officer called a warning to each other. Each one called a warning.
And this warning was to the police officers?
Yes, between the two of them.
What warning was made to halt?
Well, before that, during the chase, they had been yelling for him to halt, both officers.
Now, you have testified, have you not, Mr. Hopper, that the car came to a sudden stop. Is that so?
Yes.
And that you couldn't actually make out exactly what happened. Is that so?
I didn't say that. I said that I had lost a momentary glance of him, that I did not see him turn. I saw him after he had turned.
You saw him after he had turned?
Yes.
And so you didn't see him turn, raising his right arm?
I saw his right arm coming from his right side after he had turned.
Remember, it's what, 10 o'clock on an October night? AC is visible in the police headlights, and he's moving fast. There's a dirt mound that stopped the police car, but not AC.
When he first left the mound, had the car stopped?
He was going over the mound, I would say, about the time the car was being brought to a halt.
And this is the time you momentarily lost a glimpse of him?
Yes.
So you're not sure then, are you, whether he raised his right arm or not?
Yes, I am.
You can say definitely that you saw it?
Yes, because when I saw him, he had turned and his right hand, right arm, was coming from his right side.
Hopper has now used those exact words. His right arm was coming from his right side 4 times. You know, there is one more person I want to ask about that turn. That moment when A.C. Hall allegedly turned toward his pursuers. That person, Howard Moore, Jr.
They probably believed that he turned because they needed to believe that he turned because they didn't want to present themselves as just recklessly shooting a human being. And, you know, belief is real to the person who holds a particular belief. That's why the physical testimony is so persuasive, because you can't argue with it. The bullet entered in his back. He apparently was not turned.
Donald Lee Hollowell, the civil rights attorney who had won the acclaim Mr. Civil Rights, has arrived on the scene. He'd been unable to attend the first day of the inquest, so he'd sent his young protege, Howard Moore, Jr. But Hollowell was there for the second day, alongside Moore. The older man was already famous for litigating civil rights cases. Never an easy thing for a black lawyer in a southern courtroom in the 1950s. He argued in courts in which judges turned their backs on him, and opposing lawyers openly used racial slurs. Donald Lee Hollowell represented Martin Luther King Jr. in more than one civil rights case, and student activists had a chant that they used when they occupied segregated businesses. It went this way: King is our leader. Hollowell is our lawyer. We will not be moved. So Hollowell was a formidable figure in court, even in courts where he wasn't welcome. Howard Moore spoke of his former boss and his mentor with affection.
Mr. Hollowell was indeed brilliant. He was brilliant. He was fearless. And if you ever wanted to meet a Christian gentleman, he was. In all the years I knew him from 1952 until he died. I never heard him use a curse word. I never heard Mr. Hollowell say an unkind word about anyone, friend or foe.
Now, as Donald Hollowell steps forward to question Barnett Hopper, Hollowell wants a concession. Perhaps AC turned, perhaps he didn't. But Hollowell forces Hopper to concede that all the shooting went one way.
When did you first describe the pistol to the officers?
When they began looking for the weapon.
They didn't know that there was a weapon, did they?
Not exactly, no.
Well, they didn't know?
No.
But there hadn't been any shots fired in the direction you were? That is, coming from the direction where AC was in the direction where you were?
No.
At no time did you hear any shots other than the shots which were fired by officers Durden and Brown?
No.
What is the jury thinking at this point? Well, according to Barnett Hopper, the officers did shout numerous warnings to A.C. Hall to stop, and Hopper insisted that A.C. did turn toward the officers in a threatening way. Now, that testimony, if true, supported the officers' decision to fire. But A.C. didn't appear to have anything in his hand, and he definitely didn't fire on the police. You add that to the fact that he was shot in the back and that the police may have planted a gun at the scene. But this thing isn't over. Maybe the police will offer some additional evidence, some stronger testimony, something. Now, I can see where the jury was probably growing more and more skeptical of the justification for the shooting. But I also understand the weight of history. White jurors always rule in favor of white defendants, right? Wasn't that just the way it was? Next on Buried Truths. Doris Hopper, the 18-year-old who identified A.C. Hall as the gun thief, comes in for withering cross-examination about what she saw and what she didn't see.
So then the only thing you can identify as the person you saw running, as the person you saw get out of the car, was his general size and that the shirt tail was out?
Yes. And by when you see someone and you see them again, you're pretty sure you see the same person.
That's our reenactment of what Doris Hopper said at the 1962 inquest. In 2019, I was able to reach her on the phone.
Hello?
I'm trying to reach Doris Hopper, please.
This is she.
That conversation on the next episode of Buried Truths.
Buried Truths is a production of WABE, Atlanta. There are a lot of ways you can get more connected to the work we're doing. Sign up for our newsletter at wabe.org/buriedtruths. You'll get historic photos, documents, and more info about the case. Bring Buried Truths into the classroom by downloading lesson plans for middle and high school students, and follow us on social media. We're at Buried Truths Podcast. And of course, as always, please subscribe if you haven't already and leave us a review. It'll help others find this show. If you have any information related to this case, write or send a voice memo to hank@buriedtruths.org. Hank Klibanoff is a former newspaper reporter and editor and co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Race Beat. Today, he's a professor at Emory University. The Buried Truths team includes David Bereswain, Richard Hallix, Catherine Dautrick, Marilyn Gwax, J.N. Berry, and Christine Dempsey. The actors in this episode included Matt Nitschy, Freddie Ashley, Robbie Owenby, Sarah Hallix, Neil Gant, and Daviar Snipes. Thanks to Emory University and its Centers for Digital Scholarship and Faculty Excellence. And another big thanks to the nearly 100 students who've taken the Civil Rights Cold Cases class that Hank Klibanoff teaches at Emory. And thank you for listening to Buried Truths.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.